Today, leaks, sleaze, a chatty rap, and the Prime Minister's cash for curtains. It's been a particularly bad week for Boris Johnson. For months, information has been leaked to the press from inside Downing Street. And now, after a series of damaging stories, he's been forced to answer questions in Parliament about his behaviour. Some of these stories can be traced back to a key meeting that took place in the Cabinet Room last October. There, Boris Johnson was told that because of rising COVID infections, he would need to lock down the country again.
Matt Hancock is involved, Michael Gove is involved, Rishi Sunak is involved. They're putting quite a lot of pressure on the Prime Minister to say, look, you know what? It's going to have to be another lockdown. He's kind of resisting it, but gets worn down by the evidence. And then that sort of meeting breaks up, but it's not entirely clear what has been finally agreed.
The details of that meeting were leaked to the press, which forced the Prime Minister to suddenly announce the lockdown.
Good evening, and apologies for disturbing your Saturday evening with more news of COVID. And I can assure you I wouldn't do this unless it was absolutely necessary. But
that wasn't the end of the story. On Monday, there was another leak from that same meeting.
Mr. Speaker, it was reported this week, including in the Daily Mail, the BBC and ITV, backed up by numerous sources, that at the end of October, the Prime Minister said he would rather have, and I quote, bodies pile high than implement another lockdown.
It is a very damaging claim to put to the Prime Minister, especially if people believe that he was capable of saying it, Ben Wallace.
The Prime Minister is lots of things, but he is not a cruel person.
This is the Prime Minister who is in a hospital himself in intensive care. The idea that he would say any such thing, I find incredible. I was in that room. I never heard language of that kind.
And yesterday, the Electoral Commission opened an investigation into how Boris Johnson paid for his flat to be refurbished, the result of yet another leak. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, allegations of sleaze and misconduct. But will any of this actually harm Boris Johnson? Raphael Baer, you're a columnist for The Guardian, and you've talked a bit there about the very damaging information that was leaked about that lockdown meeting last year. But there have been other leaks too, haven't there? What have they revealed?
Well, there's been a pattern of it, which seems to have accelerated, it must be said, after Dominic Cummings left Downing Street at the end of last year.
Leaving for the final time. One of the most influential figures in Westminster propelled out of the door after a power struggle that erupted publicly and left Downing Street in turmoil.
Around March, this story about the flat above number 10 that the Prime Minister shares with his fiancée, Carrie Symons, was to be refurbished. And there were questions about how that would be financed. It was going to be expensive, tens of thousands of pounds. There is an allowance for that, but it obviously wasn't sufficient for their tastes.
Downing Street has described as speculation reports that the Prime Minister wants to set up a charity to pay for the refurbishment of his official flat. The Daily Mail has suggested that Boris Johnson would like wealthy Conservative backers to meet the cost of the redecoration of the apartment.
And this story about complex, let's say, arrangements that were somehow going to be put in place to allow this financing to happen and not come out directly out of the Prime Minister's pocket, leaked in March. And then in April, there was another leak, also an exchange of text messages. This time, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, messaged the Prime Minister, essentially complaining that the UK had thwarted a Saudi takeover of Newcastle United Football Club. And the Prime Minister appears to have dispatched Eddie Lister, his Gulf envoy, to try and smooth things over. This is bad in all sorts of ways, not least because US intelligence reports blame Mohammed bin Salman directly for authorising the very brutal, savage murder of a journalist who had been reporting on human rights abuses in Saudi Arabia. So all in all, this is not someone necessarily who it looks good for the Prime Minister to be on intimate text contact with.
And then last week, there was another leak, which revealed Boris Johnson had been texting the businessman Sir James Dyson.
BBC News has seen a series of texts in which Boris Johnson offers to fix tax rules on behalf of the businessman Sir James Dyson, a prominent supporter of the Conservative Party.
What was that all about?
Well, the essence of that is that James Dyson, famously manufactures Hoovers, was in the frame to provide some ventilators, some manufacturing help for the pandemic effort. And he was in a communication with the Prime Minister about the terms of that, because an issue had been raised between James Dyson and the Treasury, essentially saying, this is going to be hard for me to do because there are tax implications in terms of my staff coming over and working in the UK, and I want this sorted. There was some problem or delay in getting that fixed, and the Prime Minister in that message appeared to be indicating, yes, I'm on this, we can fix this for you.
I will fix it tomorrow. The Prime Minister's direct assurance in a text message to one of the wealthiest businessmen in the country. Boris Johnson wrote, Rishi says it's fixed, referring to the Chancellor. When later pressed again for assurances that the firm would pay no more if staff based overseas spent more time in the UK to work on the project, he wrote, you can take it that we are backing you to do what you need.
So obviously from the Prime Minister's point of view, that is, I'm trying to get ventilators, we're in the middle of a pandemic, this is me being the good guy. And to his critics, that indicates doing tax favours for an overseas businessman on terms that lots of other business people don't get to have because they don't have the Prime Minister's mobile phone number.
Last Thursday, The Telegraph, The Sun and The Times broke an extraordinary story that the person allegedly revealing all of this information was the Prime Minister's former advisor, Dominic Cummings.
That was a very explosive thing to say, because Cummings had been such an important, influential person in the Downing Street administration and in British politics over the last few years. The suggestion that he had been the figure to blow up the news schedule under the Prime Minister's own nose last October, going into that second lockdown, was a pretty serious thing to be saying.
What seems remarkable is that Boris Johnson apparently actually took this story to the papers himself. He called the editors up that day. And this is an extraordinary thing, isn't it, for a Prime Minister to do?
Now, we know, or I've certainly been told by many people who've worked with Boris Johnson, that he's not a chess player. You know, he doesn't think two or three moves ahead. He acts on instinct a lot of the time. And the fact that he decided, for whatever reason, and we can speculate as to what these reasons might have been, to point the finger at Cummings at the end of last week, suggests that the leaks had really got under his skin. That's the act of a man who is angry, wounded, upset, and feels he needs to do something, anything, to move the needle on a story that he's not happy about. The fact that he chose to pick a fight with someone who is a lot more strategic than the Prime Minister and extremely tenacious in trying to destroy his enemies suggests that Boris Johnson didn't really think this one through.
You've used the word enemies there. What does this tell us about how the relationship between Dominic Cummings and Boris Johnson has changed? I mean, they used to be so close, and Boris defended Dominic Cummings so much last year during the Barnard Castle scandal.
And I concluded that in travelling to find the right kind of childcare, at the moment when both he and his wife were about to be incapacitated by coronavirus, and when he had no alternative, I think he followed the instincts of every father and every parent. And I do not mark him down for that.
The important thing to remember is that, and this is going to sound perhaps more brutal than it needs to be, but Boris Johnson doesn't really have any friends. I mean, he's a big, like, humming, fizzing ball of political ambition, neediness, and lust for power. And he recognised that Dominic Cummings had been stupendously effective in the referendum. And he recognised that he needed someone like that in his operation when he became Prime Minister, and he brought him back in. But that doesn't necessarily mean they were friends. And it wasn't entirely clear, and still isn't actually entirely clear, who was using whom in that situation. Because Cummings sort of has a very clear, rigid ideological framework that he applies to things, and a very clear agenda of his own. Johnson doesn't. He has kind of mulchy, wobbly, vague sort of prejudices and sort of instincts, but there's no system to it. And they worked quite well together because Johnson was the sort of charismatic wobbly jelly that could be poured into the stiff mold of Cummings's rigorous approach. So the relationship seems to have unraveled then quite suddenly towards the end of last year, where there was a culture clash and a factional feud inside Number 10, broadly speaking, between the old referendum vote leave crew led by Dominic Cummings and his deputy Lee Kane, and another faction, for want of a better word, around Carrie Symons, Prime Minister's fiance, and others who didn't like the macho, constant war-footing strategy and approach that the whole vote leave referendum team brought to it. And to cut a long story short, it seems that Carrie Symons won and Lee Kane was out. And shortly after that, Dominic Cummings was out as well.
Dominic Cummings has been pretty quiet over the last few months since he left Downing Street, as I remember it, with some incredible photos of him walking out the front door with his box of papers.
Dominic Cummings, a close ally, was expected to stay on until the end of the year. But after a conversation with Boris Johnson today, it was decided he should go immediately.
And then last Friday, after these allegations came out in the papers, he decided to share his side of the story in the way that he usually does, in a blog post. Let's just go through what he wrote in that particular post and start with those texts between James Dyson and Boris Johnson. What did he say about those?
What Cummings essentially says is that he was aware of the exchange and he did have WhatsApp messages relating to the Dyson-Johnson conversation on his phone, but he wasn't the leaker in that case, that he wasn't the person who passed them to Laura Koonsberg of the BBC, and he's happy to surrender his device for forensic examination by anyone who wants to try and prove otherwise, because whoever it is who's been accusing him of leaking that particular thing is, in his view, lying.
So he denied leaking those messages, and he also denies being the chatty rat, the leak at that October lockdown meeting. Who does he point the finger at?
What he said effectively is that not only was he not responsible for this sort of chatty rat leak back in October, but that he thinks Henry Newman, who was then one of Michael Gove's special advisors, now currently working for Number 10, had been identified by the cabinet secretary, Sir Simon Case, as a likely candidate, as you know, all the fingers pointed to Henry Newman. And that when this information had been brought to the prime minister, and this is the perhaps one of the most explosive allegations in the blog, the prime minister had been very unhappy about this because Henry Newman is a friend of Carrie Symons. And the PM had effectively said, oh dear, well, in that case, the leak inquiry will have to stop because I can't possibly, you know, have one of Carrie's friends done over it by this. And Dominic Cummings, casting himself as the good guy, is appalled, allegedly, by the idea that the Prime Minister might be thinking about trying to abort a leak inquiry because it would damage one of his fiancé's friends.
We should say Henry Newman denies being the so-called chatty rat. What has come out in the last few days is there could be more than one. And according to the Cabinet Secretary, Simon Case, we may never know who that rat or who those rats actually are.
Given the time that has now passed, I think it's probable that the team will not successfully identify the source or sources, but work is ongoing.
The third point in Dominic Cummings' blog is about the story which has really caught the public's attention this week, how Boris Johnson paid for the refurbishment of the Downing Street flat that he shares with Carrie Symons and their son.
Who initially, and Prime Minister, initially is the key word here, who initially paid for the redecoration of his Downing Street flat?
Mr. Speaker, when it comes to misleading Parliament, he may recollect that it was...
What does Cummings say about
ago,
that?
What he says is that the Prime Minister discussed ways to finance this renovation and to get Tory party donors to pay for it because it was going to be expensive. And the Cummings suggestion is that the ways in which the Prime Minister had tried to do that were, in Cummings' words, unethical, foolish, possibly illegal, and almost certainly broke the rules on proper disclosure of political donations. And then Cummings adds that he, of course, refused to help Boris Johnson organise whatever scheme he had in mind.
I think to understand this, we should say, you know, every Prime Minister has redecorated that number 11 flat in Downing Street since Tony Blair first moved into it. But ordinarily, you know, where do Prime Ministers get that money from? I mean, is it normally paid for by the public?
There's a £30,000 allowance, essentially, to fix it up to your tastes. And it's reasonable that the head of the government should have a flat that he or she likes and is comfortable to live in. I mean, we're not expecting them to be completely austere about it. But £30,000 is a lot of money. And you can't just sort of start knocking through walls and stuff anyway, because it's a grade one listed building and there's only so much you can do to it. And so the fact that that was not deemed sufficient, and in fact, it has been said that the complaint via Carrie Symons rather than Boris Johnson was that they needed to replace Theresa May's chosen decor because it was a John Lewis nightmare, I believe was the expression, is damaging in a different way because it culturally suggests a power couple who are hopelessly out of touch, both with the resources that are available to ordinary people and even the tastes, because I think most people think of John Lewis as pretty high end.
Aside from the public being just totally appalled by the fact that people couldn't cope with some John Lewis furnishings, as so many of us love John Lewis, I think, Ralph. Why else, you know, is this story important? I mean, have any rules been broken here in the way that the Prime Minister tried to finance the refurbishment of this property?
Right, there are two dimensions to this. There is the sort of cultural thing, which is why is the money that's there not enough for you? But also is more problematic because you are expected to register political donations with the Electoral Commission, and there are conventions on that side in terms of what those donations are for, and doing up the flat isn't one of them. And on top of that, if this money was provided by a Tory donor and not declared in a timely way or registered in the correct way, then that in itself becomes a breach of the ministerial code. To understand why that exists as a stipulation, you just have to think, if someone gave the Prime Minister a significant amount of money to do up their flat, what would be the reason for that? What might be the quid pro quo? And if the Prime Minister had no intention of that person's identity ever being made public, then that would, I think, be a pretty serious and obvious breach of basic rules of public office and decency.
Number 10 is still saying that the Prime Minister paid for this himself, but what they haven't addressed is whether he did initially take money from a donor before paying it back. A Conservative peer, Lord Brownlow, has been named as having donated £58,000 for the refurbishment, and now all of this will be investigated by the Electoral Commission as they think an offence may have been committed.
The Electoral Commission has begun a formal investigation into the way the refurbishment of Boris Johnson's flat was paid for. It said there were reasonable grounds to suspect that the rules were broken. A spokesman for the Prime Minister says he paid for the work himself, but has not commented on whether he had originally been loaned the money by the Conservative Party.
On Dominic Cummings, though, he claims he has evidence to support all of his allegations. Is there more to come from him, do you think?
The idea that he has this sort of Watergate file of dirt on the Prime Minister is simultaneously preposterous and entirely believable, which says a lot about who Dominic Cummings is and the way that he operates. We know that he is supposed to be appearing in front of a parliamentary select committee towards the end of May. So obviously he's ramping up expectations about what will emerge there. Now, my first instinct was that he might be satisfied for now because he's got this kind of deterrent effect. He's saying, right, shut up, I can destroy you, so don't say anything more. I was speaking to a Conservative former cabinet minister who worked with him and knows him quite well, who took a different view, which is that Cummings never leaves someone injured. You know, that once he has decided that he has an enemy, he wants to destroy them, and he is sort of sufficiently vindictive that that's what he will set out to do.
Is Cummings credible? Is what he says believable, do we think?
The sort of the Downing Street line has been channeled through helpful, obedient cabinet ministers, is that you can't really trust anything Dominic Cummings says, that he's a sort of an unreliable narrator.
Well, a lot of people will have seen Dominic Cummings for the first time ever last year when he gave a press conference in the Rose Garden, number 10. They'll have come to their own views, I'm sure, the public. And meanwhile, the Prime Minister continues to get on with the key things that really do matter to people, the people's priorities. So, you know,
which is broadly true. I think a lot of people, you know, from the Barnard Castle episode will have a very low opinion of Dominic Cummings's honesty. But at the same time, that doesn't really help the government if what they're saying is you mustn't trust this awful mendacious maniac who happens also to have not that long ago been the closest advisor to the Prime Minister and the person responsible for the government strategy ad for Brexit. I don't see how that doesn't at some level also rebound back onto the government.
Coming up, pressure is mounting on Boris Johnson. A week out from local elections, how damaging could these revelations be? These leaks are pretty extraordinary, Raf, but I think a lot of people will hear about them and think this all just sounds like Westminster infighting. So why should we care?
There's an interesting question more broadly, isn't there, about if people are relaxed about the sort of lack of integrity in a prime minister, do you just accept that that's the state of politics at the moment and not get too exercised about it? And that's a council of despair, really, isn't it? Because ultimately, this is not the way it's supposed to be done. This is not actually normal. I mean, another very important thing to remember is that now that we are coming out, or it feels at least for the time being, coming out of the pandemic and the vaccine program has worked quite well, the government really wants, Boris Johnson in particular, really wants the sort of the waters to close over the top of the whole of 2020. And the danger there is you forget actually how chaotic it was. The indecision, the prevarication, the fact that the Prime Minister went into the first lockdown reluctantly too late, probably came out much too fast. The fact that when it looked like a second lockdown was going to be necessary, they were entertaining all sorts of quite fringe views on about lockdown skepticism and the determination, for example, to press ahead with the Christmas easing already when all the evidence was that things were getting out of control. And it was only really at the very last minute the Prime Minister accepted that he couldn't just say to people, it's Christmas, have fun. There were some very, very bad, dangerous decisions that were made that really resulted in more people dying of COVID-19 than needed to. And the fact that we now have through these leaks an opportunity to understand quite how badly some of that stuff was administered and quite where the Prime Minister was on that stuff is all the more important because there will be such a strong political imperative from number 10 to just draw a veil over the whole of that year.
Do you think that any of this will actually harm Boris Johnson? More details have also come out recently about his alleged affair with Jennifer Acurie. And last weekend, we learned that he supposedly endorsed the now failed European Super League before publicly denouncing it days later. Will any of this stuff stick?
There are different categories of offence, aren't there, in terms of behaviour? I think the question of personal and sexual morality is different now to what it was even 20 or 30 years ago. Certainly different as it's differentially applied to men as opposed to women. There's a huge hypocrisy in that respect. But ultimately, do people know that Boris Johnson lies about sex and lies to women and betrays them? Yes. Has that damaged him at all? No. Will it? No. That seems to be part of his roguish brand, the sort of cult of banter around him that insulates him from things that might have damaged other candidates and other politicians. What I think is different is whether the roguishness then starts to extend into questions of finance, money, greed and business in a way that feels more like conventional political corruption. So these things can change very quickly.
They can, but as you say, Boris Johnson has this Teflon quality. And does that mean this is actually quite a difficult one for Labour to cut through on? I mean, they've been going hard on the Tory sleaze message.
It's about integrity and it's about taxpayers' money. And every day there's more evidence of this sleaze and frankly, it stinks.
But actually, does this really land with voters? Does it get them anywhere?
And there'll be a generation who remember the mid-90s and sleaze and the gruesome total unravelling of John Major's government and sleaze being the dominant word at the time. And now where we are in the political cycle doesn't feel to me like a 92 to 97 sort of moment. An awful lot has changed since the 90s. And certainly the position the Labour Party is in is different to what it was then. We're not that long after an election where the Labour Party did very badly and Keir Starmer, for whatever reason during the pandemic, found it pretty hard to establish his credentials as a clear rival offering something very different to Boris Johnson. And on top of that, I think certainly since the MPs' expenses scandal and generally over the last decade or so, the culture has now changed to an extent that when there is some kind of allegation of corruption or some scandal, as much as thinking it's the same old Tories, it's Tory sleaze, some people are inclined to think it's all politicians, it's political sleaze, and it damages the whole political edifice, the infrastructure of Westminster, as much as it does just the Tories. I think Labour still have their work cut out, pivoting from aren't these people awful to, and therefore what you should really want is a Labour government.
Can the Prime Minister tell the House categorically, yes or no, did he make those remarks or remarks to that effect?
Prime Minister.
No, Mr. Speaker, and I think what...
There's only so long you can govern a country that badly and get away with it, I think. So what you sense is that Boris Johnson's fundamental political skill is in getting out of the scrapes that his fundamental unsuitability for the job gets him into. And so you will get another crisis along after this one before too long.
Raf, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
That was Raphael Baer. Read his excellent column about Boris Johnson, his character, and what this might all mean for him at theguardian.com, where our Westminster team are covering this story as it develops over on the live blog. You should also listen to the latest episode of the Guardian Politics weekly podcast, where you can hear Zoe Williams and Sonia Soda assess the fallout from the past week with Jess Elgar. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Hannah Moore and Ned Miles. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.